Senate confirmation hearings over the decades pretty much failed to catch people's attention. That certainly changed with the Robert Bork hearing as they continue to draw the attention of people for political and even several other personal purposes. While many thought that Bork hearings were the worst of the worst, and maybe even the Clarence Thomas hearings were as tabloid as possible, the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings quickly surpassed both those benchmarks. What was designed to be an examination of a career was turned into an attempt to assassinate a character. What you watched, by the way, wasn't all the story. My next guest, along with her co-author, presents the complete picture of those hearings, along with the strategies and the political plays within them, as well as behind them. Their huge best-selling book, it was a number one on Amazon even before it was released, is Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and The Future of the Supreme Court, co-authored by Policy Director with the Judicial Crisis Network, Harry Severino. Along with my next guest, Senior Editor at The Federalist, Molly Hemingway. Thanks for being here today, Molly.
It is great to be here with you.
TheFederalist.com as well as JudicialNetwork.com, two relevant websites for the co-authors, and we have them over at our page as well. Got to tell you, Molly, as one would expect, I was addicted to watching the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. I thought I could figure it all out. I thought I knew everything about it. But Justice on Trial filled in a whole bunch of blanks as far as I'm concerned, and I was a diehard viewer of the whole thing, so I can imagine what it's going to be as far as a wake-up call for the casual observer. So congratulations on you and Carrie doing that.
Well, thank you. That actually kind of is what we thought, too. I covered the hearings. Carrie was working on the hearings. We thought we knew everything. We knew it was a good story, but we interviewed more than 100 people, you know, lots of people at the White House, including the president, all three branches of government. We had, everyone in the Senate, the Justice Department, members of the Supreme Court and whatnot. And once we got talking to all these people, we realized, oh, we didn't even know half the story. And we thought we knew a lot. So it was fun to learn more about what was happening behind the scenes.
Starting with the obvious, now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, that's that one time in the hearing when we saw that one, really the one and only emotional outburst he gave. Judging by what I read in Justice on Trial, unless someone had pulled him off, would we have seen those outbursts more often in that chamber?
Well, his whole testimony actually was pretty emotional, but there was that one point where Amy Klobuchar is going after him and he kind of bites back, and everyone thought that did not go well for him. And his own team thought that didn't go well for him. So when she asks him if he's a drunk or something and he says, no, or you, everyone says, oh, no, you know, you went too far. And he goes back to his room where he's, you know, going in between during breaks. And his team says, yeah, you need to apologize for that. Specifically, his wife, Ashley Kavanaugh, says, you need to apologize. And I'm not even sure if he was still so angry at what they were doing to him, or so, you know, he's just been accused of serial gang rape. They're questioning everything about his character. And we learned actually from interviews with various Supreme Court justices that whether they've had easy confirmation hearings or difficult ones, none of them particularly like that a bunch of senators who aren't necessarily paragons of virtue are questioning their integrity. But yeah, so he came back, apologized, and moved back on. But it was interesting to learn that.
And you have to figure, too, blanket statement such as it is, but for the most part, any man or woman who sits on the courts, by and large, are private individuals. So these hearings and these confirmation hearings have to be like the ultimate negative for their psyche.
And they're used to just deciding issues of law. They don't have that. They are private, yes, and their whole career, they have rules in their courtroom about how to behave. And that's another thing we learned, that and when you're in these Senate hearings, senators don't have to follow the rules of a courtroom. They can, they can do things that would get you thrown out of a courtroom, such as when Kamala Harris tries to lay a perjury trap for Brett Kavanaugh by insinuating that he must have had some nefarious conversation with one of 1,000 people at a law firm. And he thinks she might know something that she's specifically asking about, so he's being very careful about how he responds. And they later realize she was just making the whole thing up. And that is the kind of behavior that would not be acceptable in a court of law. But it's totally fine, apparently, in the Senate.
If you look at the Senate, who had the most weight, the biggest load to carry for this whole situation, Mitch McConnell or Chuck Grassley?
That's a great question. And that was one of the things that we explored. I think a lot of people give credit to Mitch McConnell for judges. It's something he cares deeply about. And we certainly do tell the story of how much his office worked to make sure that the Kavanaugh confirmation was secure. But none of it would have worked without Chuck Grassley. And he headed the Senate Judiciary Committee at that time. I don't think I realized what a difficult balance he had. And it took everything. As we learned, once Jeff Flake comes in, you know, once we learn more about what Jeff Flake is doing on those last days, to just get him out of that committee. And if he didn't get out of that committee, there would be no vote on the Senate floor, or it certainly wouldn't be a successful vote on the Senate floor. And that last day after Christine Blasey Ford and Justice Kavanaugh have testified, we detail this scene where the committee basically completely breaks down. Jeff Flake is huddling with Chris Coons. They're trying to figure out a way to further delay the confirmation through an FBI, an additional supplemental FBI investigation. But there's this scene off of their hearing room where all these senators are shoved into this tiny room. And then some of them are even shoved into tinier rooms. Some are in the bathroom of that tiny room. Some are in the phone booth of that tiny room. They're fighting. They literally almost come to blows. Spit is flying. People are stepping on each other's feet, and they're just screaming at each other because they're so – basically, the Republicans by that point were so fed up with the Democratic shenanigans that they had endured for months.
So Molly Hemingway, who along with Carrie Severino are the co-authors of Justice on Trial, the Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme Court. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Let's turn it over to another angle here, too, as far as the Senate is concerned. Who was the bigger winner and the bigger loser, Dianne Feinstein, Susan Collins?
Well, I think people who've covered the Senate are aware of the powerful force that Susan Collins is, but maybe the rest of the country didn't realize how important she is. She really genuinely is a moderate, not a conservative. She is a Republican. She takes her role extremely seriously, and she begins the confirmation process by actually hiring on additional staff. She's not an attorney. She hires on a bunch of attorneys to go through Judge Kavanaugh's record down to the footnotes. I mean, she is reading through to the footnotes. She goes through everything, and she meets with him, and she asks good questions. By all accounts of everyone who is in the meeting, she asks the most thorough questions of any senator. So she takes her job very seriously. She starts receiving death threats. Her staff are receiving death threats. This actually began before the nomination even was announced. They're sending hangers as an implied threat about abortion to her and her offices. And her house gets attacked with what someone says is ricin. And, it's unbelievable what she goes through. And she comes out and stays strong and is not bullied. And you compare that to Dianne Feinstein, who gets a letter from a constituent claiming she's been a victim of abuse. She does not report it to the authorities. She does not put it through the Senate Judiciary Committee's regular system, which is, you know, these kinds of allegations actually come through for nominees, frankly, all the time. And so there's a system in place where you evaluate the allegation, and you can do it while protecting the anonymity of the accuser or protecting the name of the accuser. She circumvents that process. She instead connects the accuser with a high-profile Democratic attorney who's known for running public relations campaigns for her clients. And I think that did not go well for her. It did not make her look like a profile in courage.
As I'm reading Justice on Trial, I'm coming around the last turn for the home stretch, and the narrative gets more and more crazy with the accusers and the accusations. And I'm thinking, you know, if your narrative is starting to legitimize someone like a Michael Avenatti, you desperately need to sit down and rethink your narrative.
Well, and yet, did you get the feeling that anyone felt that way? I mean, the original accusation, which was so perfectly, you know, a perfect combination of vague and specific. She basically didn't remember anything but had a few specific details. That was at least within the realm of possible. By the time you're getting to, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, this federal judge, was secretly running a gang rape cartel going after underage youth. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. And yet the media took it extremely seriously. In part, they said, well, he has a sworn affidavit. We uncovered that NBC News knew prior to the confirmation vote that the supposed witness to support the Avenatti claim told NBC News that she wasn't supporting the claim. And they sat on that. They didn't cover it until weeks after the confirmation was over. The media do not there are problems with the media in general, and it can get boring to talk about. But with the Kavanaugh battle in particular, they just openly took sides and they threw out journalistic standards. And it was really interesting to learn more about the specifics of that.
It's just an incredible story that Molly and Carrie unfold with the facts and the first-person stories. This isn't one of those, I won't mention the author's name, but the supposed third-name sources or third-tier information that you often get in books like this. This is direct from point A to point B. So that's why Justice on Trial really is the factual book that you need to read. It also made me think, too, about the time that, I always look for the odd pieces and something like this. This was probably the first time we saw Lindsey Graham off of John McCain's leash in that one moment in the committee hearing. And when he opened fire, that was like, I'm watching, it was like, whoa.
And that was such a cathartic moment, I think, for people. It was, as part of writing the book, we would go back through and watch the hearings again. One thing that struck us was that no one had defended Kavanaugh since like 10 a.m. that morning when Grassley introduced both witnesses and had nice words to say about both of them until Graham's comment. And so the country was riveted by these hearings, and they're watching this. And it was just such a roller coaster, Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and then Kavanaugh's defense and all this tough questioning and everything. So that by the time Graham says, "You all, want power. I hope you never get it," with that amazing speech, it felt, a lot of people were just, thank you for this moment. And it was important. Now, he is the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and some people are wishing that he had investigated some of the shenanigans by Democrats more instead of just letting them pass. So it'll be interesting to see if such an investigation does happen, because if people aren't held accountable for violating Senate rules and procedures or for making up accusations or for playing around with false allegations, there's no way to stop it from happening in the future.
Well, that's the thing. It's when President Trump gets to name another Supreme Court justice, will the left say, okay, we learned our lesson, or would the left be compelled to go for the, quote, the win this time by ratcheting it up even further?
One of the things we look at in Justice on Trial is how contentious Supreme Court nominations are more a result of the person who's being replaced and what kind of justice they are. Let me put it this way. Anthony Kennedy was a swing vote. He wasn't a liberal bloc justice. And you saw how crazy everybody got about replacing him with a Trump nominee. So just imagine how apocalyptic it could get if it is one of the liberal bloc justices that Trump gets to replace. That's when you see even more anger. When Scalia, a stalwart originalist, is replaced by Gorsuch, another stalwart originalist, you didn't see, they acted quite extreme. The Democrats blew up the filibuster, which is a thing that helps the minority party have a say in judicial nominations. But they didn't act as crazy as they did with Kavanaugh. And if you look at the pattern, it's when you're replacing, a Thurgood Marshall with a Clarence Thomas that you see things really heat up.
It is an incredible read. It is we all love those behind-the-scenes looks. You won't get any more behind-the-scenes with facts and what Justice on Trial, the Kavanaugh confirmation, and this feature the Supreme Court delivers. Co-authored by Carrie Severino and my guest this morning, Molly Hemingway. Molly, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. Have a great day.